Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:03 p.m. on Wednesday, March 27, 2019. Before we begin, I want to thank Robert Montenegro, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have sound, have a transcript of our meetings, and Madison Truitt from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I will remind members of the committee and everyone in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Wool, Representative Kopp, Representative Shaw, and myself, Representative Clayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is presentations from two employees of the Department of Corrections. We have Laura Brooks, Deputy Director, Health and Rehabilitation Services, Department of Corrections, and Michael Matthews, Research Analyst, Research and Records, Department of Corrections. We will now open for their invited testimony. If you can both come forward. And I will remind committee members that we're going to hear two different presentations. I'd recognize that Representative Ledoux has joined us. And I think I saw on the floor that Representative Stutz is excused, so I don't expect to see her today. They've got two different presentations, and I would encourage you to do your best to save your questions for the end of the presentations. And I think we're starting with the presentation on recidivism and reentry, and so I think, Laura, you're the lead on this one, so go ahead.
Good afternoon. For the record, this is Laura Brooks with the Department of Corrections. I'm the Deputy Director for Health and Rehabilitation Services. So today we have some information for you on recidivism for the department. And so, thank you. I first just wanted to give you a quick overview of the department. This is probably all information that you've heard before, so I'm just going to move through this. But as you know, Alaska is one of six states that operates a unified correctional system, so that means we oversee both prisons and jails, prisons being where the sentenced offenders go, jails being where the unsentenced pretrial offenders are held, and we have a lot of facilities that house both. So we're quite different than most of the other states in the country. There's only six unified states in the country. System-wide, we have 12 jails and prisons, 13 field probation offices, and then we also oversee regional and community jails and halfway houses, or CRCs, through contracts. And then we also, of course, have our electronic monitoring program. Last year, we booked in over 31,000 offenders. That was 20,000 unique individuals that were booked 31,000 times. And then as of December of last year, we had just under 4,500 offenders in our jail or prison. 69% of those were felons. 45% of our population are unsentenced. And then you can see throughout our system where the rest of the offenders under our care and custody are kept. And so on any given day, we're responsible for about 9,000 or 10,000 Alaskans. This is just a breakdown of the demographics. The population by gender is pretty typical to what you'd see throughout correctional systems in this country. The age breakdown, one of our fastest growing, that's a little bit difficult to see, sorry about that. Our fastest growing population is actually those that are 50 plus. 20% of our inmate population are over 50. And on a snapshot day in 2018, we had 125 inmates who were 65 or older. And that's compared to only 82 in 2014. So we're seeing a pretty steady rise in our aging population. And then we're also seeing an increase in our juvenile population. Typically, we don't have very many in our system who have been sent to adult corrections. But one day last year, we had 12. In our system, and so that's posed some significant challenges for us on a number of levels. So for recidivism, it's important to note as we go through this that the way the statute defines recidivism, it's not just new crimes. This also includes technical probation violations. So this is felons who come back on felony charges or felony convictions, misdemeanor convictions, and also on probation violations. This next chart here, one of the things I want to make sure is clear, you'll see that our charts have data from 2015 as the last date. That's because our recidivism numbers are based on a three years post-incarceration. So in order for us to gather accurate recidivism data, we look at, we start collecting that information once they've been out at least 3 years. And that's also kind of the national standard for looking at that. So, you know, after being in the upper 60th percentile for decades, we're actually seeing a downward trend in recidivism in Alaska. So there are a lot of factors that likely play into that. A number of years ago, we started a real aggressive shift towards evidence-based practices. So our programs in custody for these individuals are evidence-based. We're always looking for that. We now use assessment tools that help us identify criminogenic needs, and I have a slide to go a little bit more in depth on that later. But when we can identify their criminogenic needs and their risk factors, that means we can focus our resources on those moderate to high-risk offenders who are most likely to reoffend. We also have, you know, reentry programs now. When this graph first started back in the early 2000s, reentry was barely even a buzzword, and now it's you know, it's what we talk about when we talk about corrections. And then we've developed a number of community partnerships and support so that when our individuals leave our system, there's some warm handoff, there's someone out there who can help them get jobs, get housing, and have those supports that they need in the community. So I think it's also just real quick important to note that the Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Statistics, did a study last year. They studied 30 states and 400,000 offenders and their recidivism data, and about two-thirds were reincarcerated within 3 years. Their number was 67.8 recidivism rate for those 30 states. So you can see Alaska is actually significantly below what the national number reflected last year.
Representative, well, we're
you want to wait to the end?
No, you can. If you've got a question, you can ask them now. I'm encouraging waiting to the end, but not saying.
Well, we've
got
about 18 pages, so
you can go ahead and ask the
question. So 2013, thank you, through the chair, and the previous graph, the 2013 looks like it's beginning of a fairly steep decline after a year of increase. So that would be people released in 2016. That's a 2013. Three-year delay to 2016, is that correct?
Through the chair, actually what this would be would, for each one of those years, that was the year those individuals were released. So they were, that cohort for 2013 were those released in 2013, but the data that we used was from 2016 for those previous 3 years.
Okay, so they're, okay, got it, thank you.
So what I often do when I look at this graph is I sometimes jot down for like the 2015, I say 2015-18, because that actually reflects their post-release conduct for the next 3 years. Same thing, so 2013 would get you through 2016.
Follow up.
Representative will follow
up. Thank you. So I guess to try to look at cause and effect of a year of increase, although it's sort of flat and then it dropped, went up, and then did a more severe drop, that was people released in 2013. When they look back in 2016, they were they recidivated at a lower rate, or started to improve. Any ideas why that happened?
So, through the chair, Representative Wool, I can't speak to true causality, but what I can tell you is there was a period in there where there was a major overhaul in our programming in our facilities. About 2013-14 would have been when we started really looking at evidence-based practices and revising our curriculums and looking at the research behind the programs that we offered. Prior to that, so that 2013, that would have been about the time that we really changed our approach to the programs. So.
Thank you. Yep.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. So on this slide, could you provide the committee with the actual numbers of people that these percentages are referring to? And I only ask because, you could go back to 2006 and see 70%. You know, if that was 70% of a smaller number, sure. Then that would certainly be something that I want to know. And then second, my question would be, how would you respond to the criticism that with higher crime rates, of course, recidivism is going down because you're not catching all the criminals out there, and if your chance of getting caught in a bigger pool of criminals is going down, of course, you know, recidivism is going to go down.
Through the chair, to Representative Easton, that again is not it's not something that we've researched, so it's not really something that I feel like I could speak well to at this point.
Okay, follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And just final question for now. Do we have anecdotes on what is happening to these inmates once they're released? Do we know that they're going straight? Do we know that they're leaving town? I mean, you know, maybe we don't have the cumulative numbers, but you know, what are you seeing? What are you hearing?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, do you mean in terms of where they're releasing to, kind of in terms of our reentry planning?
No, I mean, what's happening to them after they leave custody? Do we know?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, well, I will tell you, it depends. So, for example, a very small number of individuals actually end up on probation and parole. Only about 25% of those released from custody end up on paper or on probation and parole. So certainly those who are on probation and parole, we have a much better idea of where they are and what they're doing, obviously. The other 75%, we make referrals. Again, going back to some of the assessment tools that we have, we assess their criminogenic needs, and so we're looking at what do these individuals really need to be able to succeed in the community? Housing, substance abuse treatment, that type of thing. But with those individuals, we don't have somebody who can follow them and make sure they do that, but we still make those referrals.
Thank you.
How much they follow through with that, we don't know.
Sure.
Just one clarification. When you said about 75% of the folks aren't on probation or parole, are you including folks on misdemeanor convictions in that 75% figure, or are we talking 75% are people that are being released on felony charges?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to double check on that. I believe that includes both those who have flat timed, you know, the felons who ordinarily may have gone out on probation and parole, but for one reason or other served their entire time. But then others who it includes the misdemeanor population as well.
And as I understand, the data that you collect on recidivism is limited to felony folks that are released on felonies, which is both a function of statute, which is that's the only stuff you're supposed to track, but also the practical reality that those are the ones that you actually have more supervision of than the folks on misdemeanor.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And then I believe it's also a function of the misdemeanor population is in for such a short period of time anyway. It makes collecting some of that data more difficult.
Okay. I don't see any other questions, so you can keep rolling.
Okay. All right. So this next slide, for those releasing, this looks at the reasons they came back to us. So was it for a new misdemeanor crime, a new felony, or was it a technical violation? So the majority of those who return to custody return on technical violations, probation or parole violations. So about 58% of those who return within six months do so for probation violations. And so those are things like most commonly during that period, alcohol use, drug use.
All participants are unmuted.
Alcohol use, drug use, failure to report. So, and that kind of makes sense. So for somebody who's new to probation and parole, they haven't been to treatment maybe at this point, so they're more likely to relapse. They haven't got used to the requirements of probation and parole, so some of those technical violations maybe are more likely during that time period. So, and again, part of our responsibility when they go out on probation and parole is to intervene early in that criminal cycle. So when we see some of these signs that they may be returning to behaviors that got them incarcerated in the first place, we're going to tighten those controls. And sometimes that means bringing them back before they relapse into those old behaviors, before there's a new crime and before there's a new victim. This next slide is recidivism for new crimes. So our probation violations are down about 15% over the last 4 years. But it's also important to note that when we take out those technical violations, we still see a downward trend. 32% of recidivism is from new crimes. That does include both felony and misdemeanor crimes. And that's down 8% over the last 4 years.
Representative Cobb.
I think this question may have been asked, and I might have missed it, but my guess is the 2015 data point is because it takes a full 3 years of tracking before you can have the
through the chair.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah. Well, is there any reason to believe this trend, though, is continuing?
Through the chair to Representative Cobb. I think every year we get better and better at what we do. So I think that's the reason we keep looking at evidence-based practices and adjusting our programs and training our correctional officers, our probation officers in new things so that we can keep up with what's necessary to make sure that trend continues.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I know the earlier slide went back 5 years earlier rather than starting in 2011 year. I think on page 6 it starts in 2006. I know you hadn't prepared it, but do you have any reason to think that this graph would look different if you moved it back 5 years? Would it be kind of similar to what we see on page 6 in terms of a bit higher or about the same prior to 2011, and then the drop really begins around 2011?
Mr. Chair, we can certainly run that and submit that to the committee.
That would be great.
Yep.
And I won't ask the question, but on all the other two graphs that only have the five-year picture,
5 years.
I'd like to see the other 5 years.
Certainly.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wolf, sorry I didn't see
you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I just thought of something. Well, we talk about recidivism a lot, and the number of upper 60% sounds so unsuccessful. But if you take out all these violations, it goes way down. And you know, if you're in jail for a felony for a serious crime and then you get released and they say, well, you can't drink anymore, and then they're spotted in a bar having a beer, suddenly they're thrown back in, and that's a recidivism statistic. But really, it's not at all near the same crime that put them in. Is there any way – I mean, I guess this is the way to do it. It seems unfortunate that the number of 65% gets bandied around like that's what it is, when really it's in the low 30s right now, which is a much better statistic and maybe more realistic other than little infractions. And I'm not trying to downplay them, but as people on this committee know, I've spoken up against some of these restrictions. I think are overly restrictive and kind of unrealistic for some of them, and that would be another way to lower the recidivism rate if you don't make every small little infraction the same as the original felony that put you in.
Sounds like more a comment than a question.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay. Representative Ledoux.
Does everybody who leaves prison is on parole or probation, regardless of what they've done and whether it has anything to do with alcohol, is prohibited from drinking?
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, it really depends. Those are ordered either by the court or the parole board, and I can't really speak to the reasoning behind them. I know there's a fairly standard list, but I know there are some that don't include the alcohol restriction, but I don't know what the formula is to determine who gets that assigned and who doesn't.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And on that topic, I believe it's, I mean, if the standard condition of parole is obey all laws, and I think given the high number of folks that drugs or alcohol are connected with the original offense, isn't it typically the practice if drugs or alcohol were part of the original offense, that's typically a restriction that gets added on parole and probation?
To the chair, that's absolutely correct. And we have, as I'm sure you all are aware, about 80% of our population have drug or alcohol issues. And so it's a very common requirement.
Okay. Thank you. You can proceed.
All right, so this next slide takes a look at those who are serving time on a felony, how many of them came back on a new felony. So you can see there's also been a decline in felony recidivism. 20% of the offenders released from DOC facilities return on new felony charges within 3 years of release, and that's down 5% over the last 4 years. So this is broken down. We broke recidivism down by offense class. So on the left, you see the reason they were incarcerated. And the columns on the right show the year that they were released, as well as their recidivism rate. So recidivism is down in all offense classes except for crimes against a person and except in weapons offenses. So this includes they're returning for any new crime or a probation violation. And so some of these categories, I just wanted to explain a little bit. Public order and administration, that includes things like refusing a DNA test, hindering the prosecution, those types of things. Driving and alcohol, those are separate categories. Alcohol, for obvious reasons, includes mostly DUIs, but other alcohol-related offenses. And then driving is tends to be more things like reckless driving, vehicular manslaughter, driving without a license, that type of offense.
Question?
Representative Eastman.
Through the chair. You know, as you look at these different trends based on offense class, to what do you attribute the disparity?
Through the chair to Representative, do you mean the disparity between those that went down and those?
Right.
You know, again, with this type of data, it's really difficult to figure, you know, what the causal relationship is. I think we'd have to study each one of these a lot more to try to determine that. We have programs in our system, for example, that are very specific to sex offenses. And we have changed that curriculum over the last several years significantly. I can't say that that's the direct cause for the decrease in recidivism for that, but we are seeing better returns. So there are just a number of factors that play into these. Some of these individuals, again, where they score out on the assessment tool, some of these, when we look at the 8 criminogenic needs, score out with all of those very, very highly, and others have 1 or 2. And sometimes when you compare those assessment numbers with the crimes that they're being committed, you can see why there might be a difference in recidivism along the way. And again, when we're looking at who we're focusing our resources on, we are now looking at those higher risk offenders. So I think there's just a lot of different things that play into that.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Okay, so this is review of recidivism by offense class. So what was their original crime and what did they do to come back? So what this tells us really is that when somebody recidivates, they tend to do so within the same offense class. There's a couple of exceptions. Again, there's always an outlier, but for weapons and driving offenses, you can see that's a little bit different. But alcohol, if they came in on an alcohol crime, they came back, you know, much more frequently on an alcohol-related crime. Property crime, if that's what they were originally arrested for, they are far more likely to come back on another property crime than they are to gravitate to a different type of offense class. So this slide speaks to the risk level. As I mentioned, we do assessments now on our offenders that focus on the risk level. So we know where to focus our efforts. And so this graph shows recidivism by risk level. And understandably, those who are found to be at higher risk recidivate at the higher risk. And remember, too, that these recidivism numbers do include those probation and parole violations. So again, the higher the risk, the higher controls that we're going to put on these individuals. So hopefully we're catching them earlier with lesser behaviors than others if we weren't able to identify this by risk. So again, looking at those medium and maximum risk offenders, our goal is to, of course, intercede before there's a new crime and a new victim. So that, again, may reflect probation violations. So the highest risk for recidivism is within the first 6 months of release. 25% of people who return to the community are reincarcerated within 6 months. And again, they're new to parole, they're new to probation, they oftentimes haven't gone through substance abuse treatment. So again, we're looking at much of this being technical violations or potentially being technical violations. And so if somebody's going to recidivate, they are far more likely to do so within the first 12 months of release. More than 40% of them return within that first year. And so again, when we're focusing our reentry efforts, it really needs to be when they walk out the door, where are we sending them? What kind of supports are we, you know, putting in place for them, and, you know, what else is there that we can be doing for them during that first year that seems to be so tenuous for them? Over time, and as expected, the likelihood of returning to jail decreases. People stabilize, people get treatment, they learn how to conform their behaviors so they're not getting those technical violations. And the intensity and frequency of antisocial behavior decreases over time. We don't necessarily know whether that's a factor of age or simply a result of learning the consequences and how to avoid those consequences. But less than 6% of our population return between years 6 and 10. So this next section just talks a little bit about what we're doing to try to impact recidivism. And we've all heard, you know, this administration's stand on crime, and recidivism reduction is an important part of addressing public safety issues. So helping individuals successfully reintegrate into the community means less crime, fewer victims, and a more positive community for all of us. So how do we accomplish this? There are three principles to an effective intervention with this population. First one is identifying those who are greatest risk of reoffending. And as I said, focusing our resources on those individuals who are at greatest risk of committing a new crime. Then we target their criminogenic needs, and I'll go through those, I think, in the next slide. And then we tailor a plan to fit the offender. We do this through the risk assessment tools, through our offender management plan, and then on focused evidence-based programming. So our reentry plan really starts when they walk through the door. We are looking at their needs from their initial assessment in the booking unit throughout their incarceration. And so then when they get released, there should be a plan for them that addresses those criminogenic needs. And so these are the dynamic criminogenic needs that I've been referring to that, when changed, will change the probability of an offender's recidivism. So reducing their criminal thinking, their antisocial values, helping those individuals recognize when they are engaging in risky behavior or cycling back into their criminal thinking errors. Antisocial companions, reducing those negative associations and helping them recognize and build pro-social networks and pro-social behaviors. Building problem-solving skills, anger management, family conflict is a big issue, of course, for our individuals, and so helping these individuals learn how to build healthy relationships, communication skills. Obviously, substance abuse, as I said, about 80% of our population struggles with substance abuse issues. Providing them with employment skills, employment seeking and employment keeping skills. It's one thing to get a job for this population. It's a whole other thing to be able to maintain that for any period of time. So trying to stabilize their work life. Education, just enhancing their opportunities for education, and that includes trades. And then leisure and recreation, increasing their involvement in pro-social activities. Even if that means going to a healthy AA group, that's a step in the right direction for this population. So once we've identified the criminogenic needs of this population, we can start to build an offender management plan, our OMP. And so really what that is, that's really a roadmap that helps us develop a plan to address those needs. And it's tailored to the specific needs and the specific styles of that offender. So we look at their learning styles, we look at their criminal attitudes, their ability, their motivation, even their level of motivation plays a role in this. And we look at their strengths, what can we build on? And so then we direct them, refer them to programs in our system. We have programs for our pretrial population and then a much more robust group of programs for our sentenced population. And that offender management plan, it's a fluid document, so it changes over time. We are reassessing, we will redirect, we may add things that we didn't identify early on based on behaviors, based on their changes in their attitude and their approach to incarceration. And so that's something that we change as this offender moves through the system. And so again, then 90 days before release, that offender management plan is updated. So it really starts at incarceration, but then once they hit their sentenced facility, that's when the offender management plan really gets tightened up. Throughout their incarceration, they're directed to different programs, and then within 90 days of release, that offender management plan is updated with the eye towards transitioning to the community. And then that offender management plan, for those who are on supervision by probation and parole, that offender management plan follows them to the field, and that field probation officer picks that up and then works with them to make sure that we are still addressing those needs even after release. For some of those who don't have that probation or parole officer, we're working to develop more community supports, places like Partners for Progress and Anchorage, or the community reentry coalitions throughout the state. Those are areas that are helping these offenders continue with that offender management plan and to address those needs in the community. And then this last slide here, as I mentioned, we've aligned all our programs on the same basic premise. Using evidence-based practices has been proven to reduce recidivism. So that's really what we have tried to focus on for the last, 6 or so years. And so we have things like reentry classes, and reentry classes are pretty basic to us, but to our offenders, it's not basic at all. It's when you get released, how are you going to get, even if you have a place to live, how are you going to get there? You'd be surprised at how many people don't even think about that. Do you have an ID? Because how are you going to get a job, or how are you even going to get on a plane, or how are you going to do any number of things if you don't have an ID? Do you have health care? About 98% of our population are Medicaid eligible, and so we work with them to secure those benefits and to put that application in before they get released so that they have those supports when they hit the street. We have faith communities and mentoring. Some of that is peer mentoring, and those individuals, again, help these individuals connect to those safe, sober social supports in the community when they get released. Our mental health population is one of the most vulnerable groups of Alaskans, I think, that we have. About 65% of our population have a mental health diagnosis. And so they also recidivate at nearly twice the rate as a non-mentally ill population. And so we have, in custody, we have 24-hour hospital-level psychiatric units. We have subacute units, and we have clinicians who work with these individuals in every facility. And then we also have a team of mental health clinicians who develop reentry plans for this population, making sure that they can get their antipsychotic medications when they get out, that they have case management, that they have a safe place to live, sometimes a supervised housing. Sex offender treatment programs, we have a couple of those in custody, and then many of our communities have sex offender treatment programs in the communities. We also now have a telemedicine treatment or a telehealth treatment program so that we can allow offenders to stay in their home communities and receive sex offender treatment instead of coming to Anchorage or one of the larger communities for treatment. That just started this last year. Substance abuse programming, we have that in our facilities as well as available to our CRC folks. We have a medical social work team who, we have a very fragile group of folks who have significant medical needs and who have no idea how to navigate the medical system when they get out. So this medical social worker works with them to make sure they can make their oncology appointment or they know where to go for their surgery follow-up when they get released. And then medication-assisted treatment. For those of you who aren't familiar with that, that includes the medication Vivitrol, for example. We offer that in our facilities for folks who are getting released. They go through a screening process, and if it's not contraindicated, we will provide that to them at no charge to them, and actually no charge to the department right now because the pharmaceutical companies are providing that to us. And so we give them a shot within 2 or 3 days of release and a referral to the community. Unfortunately, what we're finding is that participation drops off significantly in the community for a variety of reasons, some of which include they don't think to go every 30 days, or it's too much to go every 30 days, or their Medicaid hasn't kicked in yet, and so they don't have a way to pay for that in the community, and that's a $750 to $1,000 injection. We are seeing some success with that, but we still need to figure out how we can make sure they they have the ability to follow up with that in the community. So that is a quick run through of some of our programs that we do offer when we're trying to address recidivism and make sure that their reentry is successful.
Further questions for Ms. Brooks? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm curious to know what are current incarceration rates compared to, say, other states? Do you know?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I don't have those numbers with me, but we can certainly get those for you.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So to go back to slide 11 for a moment, that's where we talk about the offense classes and the distribution. The data that we're looking at here, is that second offense based on the arrest, what they were charged for, or what they were convicted of?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I happen to have the research person who collected that data, and it was what they were convicted of.
Okay. Thank you. And so in those kind of situations,
or in the case of a probation or parole violation, there's no conviction. It's just a finding that they violated the conditions.
That's correct. Those have been disposed of, and they are serving a sentence on that probation violation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Go ahead, Representative.
Yeah, and actually that gets right to my question is, so we're seeing obviously a lot more recidivism based on the violations rather than necessarily new crimes. And I just want to get an idea. Could some of that be attributed to the fact that it's easier to, you know, establish that there was a violation rather than going through the work of investigation and prosecution and conviction of a new crime? Are there instances where we have someone who may have done a new crime, but we're seeing this conviction because we're focusing on the conviction and it was easier to just charge them with the violation and get them through the system, get them back for that reason?
And so just one point of clarification. The question suggested we're seeing an increase in people that are being brought back for probation and parole violations. I think the statistics you've shown shows that a very high percentage are brought back for violation of conditions, but I don't think there was ever any indication that there was a trend of that increasing. I think that's been the historical pattern for years.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. And actually, we're seeing a decrease. We're seeing a downward trend even in the probation violations as well. So through the chair,
the same trend, and I'm just trying to
answer
out
the question.
Why?
Representative, he asked the question. You can go ahead and answer the question. I just wanted to clarify that we're not seeing an increase in probation and parole violations as a within the context of all recidivism.
Through the chair, I'm afraid I can't speak as to how these are prosecuted. That's a question I think for another department. So I'm not able to answer that.
Representative Kopp.
So, yeah, I mean, one point of clarification on the just process, how this works is an offender can have two or three pages of technical violations that they're advised of, that if they are at a certain place, if they contact certain people, if they fail to make certain appointments, if they show up under the influence, the list can be quite extensive, and that's reasons why they most violate one of many rules, so to speak, but not necessarily a new crime. And I think the evidence shows the longer that they're on probation, the more likely they are to get caught up in one of the rule violations and actually a new crime.
Through the chair, you're correct. I mean, a lot of this is technical violations. What I should point out for this particular chart, though, this reflect a lot of people come back on multiple issues. So there may be a new crime, and there may also be technical violations that are included in that arrest. This chart, though, is based on the most severe crime or the most severe issue that was facing them. So if they came back on two technical violations and a new misdemeanor crime, the misdemeanor would be reflected on here. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't show the multiples that sometimes these individuals do face.
Representative Kopp, follow-up.
Thank you. It's an excellent presentation. I appreciate it. So reentry, it's such a big deal. Other than prisoner transitional housing, job training, job placement, is there anything you're I think you mentioned those three things. Is that a standard practice statewide that you do through either coordinating with nonprofits, or are you doing that with tribal entities? I'm aware that that DOC had a partnership with Tlingit Haida recently on something like this. Just wondering kind of how you're carrying out that effort right now with different groups.
Sure. Through the chair to Representative Kopp, over the last several years, we've really expanded those options. And so I would say yes for pretty much everything that you just mentioned. It really varies from community to community, of course, based on the resources that we have. Anchorage, obviously, there's a lot more varied partners that we have. But we've also found that some of the smaller communities really come together in really unique ways to address the needs of their returning citizens. So we're always reaching out for new partnerships. The department has actually just hired within the last month a new reentry coordinator, and that is her sole job, is to work on developing those relationships and building those connections in the community. And that's also something that our probation officers do every day because they live in those communities. As do our correctional superintendents. I mean, we're always trying to figure out where we can tighten that up so that when those individuals leave our facilities, they've got what they call a warm handoff. They've got some place to go and somebody who is looking out to make sure that they are have all of those things that you just listed. So it's really varied across the system.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
How long has this warm handoff been going on?
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, well, in some of our programs for a long time. For example, the mental health population that I spoke about, we have had clinicians doing that work. I actually started with the department doing that 20 years ago. And so those warm handoffs where we make sure that that very vulnerable person has a case manager and a doctor and a place to live and transportation, that's been happening for a long time with some specialized populations. The same thing with the sex offender treatment programs. A big part of that program is making sure that they have a safety net when they return to the community. And that safety net includes clergy, community elders, a number of, it might include the VPSOs, folks like that who are specially trained to deal with those folks when they come back to their communities. So on the larger scale, I would say to varying degrees, it's been happening for a long time because that's part of what our institutional probation officers and what our field probation officers kind of by definition do. But it's become much more focused in probably the last 7 or 8 years.
So if somebody from one of the nonprofits, for example, which was involved in prisoner reentry, told me that, you know, often prisoners come out of prison and they've got a couple of dollars and that's about it and they have no place to go, you'd say that that person was giving me incorrect information? Because I've heard that up until, I guess, you know, a couple of years ago, and I haven't talked to anybody since then.
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, I would not say that's not true. I would actually say that still happens. We have 17,000 releases every year. I think that's right. 17,000? we have a lot of releases every year, and we can't possibly.
Hold you
thank you.
17,000,
thank you.
We recognize there's a lot of people that get.
We
out.
Can't possibly do a warm handoff for every one of them. You're absolutely right. I wish we could, but we don't have the resources, and some of them cycle through our system so quickly, we don't even have a chance barely to acknowledge that they're in our system, much less provide them with a thorough, deep dive release plan. It's part of the nature of our system, unfortunately. And then we also have a group of folks who, quite frankly, even when we do offer it to them, they don't take it. They don't take it.
So follow-up?
Representative Ledoux.
So what percentage of the people returning from prisons to the outside world get this warm hand off?
Through the chair, we don't track that. We don't have that built into our system as a way to track that, unfortunately.
So,
Representative, one of the things we could do is we could get Partners Reentry or one of the other groups that they may not be able to tell you as a percentage of corrections, but they may be able to tell us an idea of how many, how their programs are growing or not growing in terms of how many they serve.
I'd actually like to hear that.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I may I?
Well, but Representative Eastman is next in the queue.
Yeah.
Were you finished with your follow-up, Representative?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Yeah, and on that point, Mr. Chairman, I would be curious to know the follow-up, too. Of those who did get the warm handoff, you know, what percentage of those are we seeing back again for another round? To the extent that information is available, you know, that would be very enlightening. Through the chairman, my question is, you mentioned on the last slide that there's various options for education, and I'm curious to know, particularly after someone's achieved their GED or if they already had that high school diploma, what kinds of those post-secondary options are we talking about? What is available to inmates, and then is that free, or is that something if they have some money they can put money towards? How does that work?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, the education opportunities vary from facility to facility. As you indicated, there is the GED program. There are certain facilities have options for people to get their high school diploma, and then there are even opportunities for people to take college classes. I can't tell you. I don't believe there's a charge to the individual for that, but I'm not 100% certain about that. And then we have a lot of skills, you know, trade programs that we offer as well: apprenticeships, plumbing, CDL. Hazmat, a whole host of programs that offer a trade for these individuals. So we recognize that that's a very important piece to their reentry plan, is to have a skill and education when they get out. And so we try to offer a pretty wide variety for that.
Thank you. Follow up?
Representative Eastman.
So I'm also curious to know about, you know, where someone ends up physically in corrections, you know, post-conviction. And obviously there's reasons to keep them in their local community, makes it easier for...
You're talking about the pre-release, before they get released from jail, where they're held in custody,
yep.
Okay.
And post-conviction in custody. Wanting to know, you know, certainly it's helpful, I think, in certain circumstances for relatives and friends to be able to, visitations and such. But I know there's also, you know, potentially a thought that, you know, if I already know where I'm going and it's familiar and comfortable and, you know, maybe I just want to get back there for some part of the population, to what extent does that factor into the plan to reduce recidivism? You know, do we ever put someone in a different location to sort of discourage them from coming back? Or do we always put them in the same, you know, jail that they left? Assuming that, you know, the severity of the offense is comparable.
Through the chair, if I understand your question correctly, we have a unit that a classification unit, and they look at a whole host of things that I don't even hope to understand, quite frankly, how they work through this matrix to decide where these individuals go. So one of the things that's inherent to a unified system is we have facilities such as Fairbanks Correctional Center. That's a pretrial facility, so it's a busy jail system. But then once somebody is sentenced, it's not large enough to keep them there. So they are going to get shipped to a sentenced facility. That might be Goose Creek, it might be Spring Creek. But even within that, there's some fluctuation. So if they're sentenced to a year or less, they may stay in Fairbanks, depending on the count, the number of individuals that we have in Fairbanks Correctional Center on that particular day. But then also depending on their security level, they may go to Spring Creek, or they may go to Goose Creek, or they may go to Lemon Creek. It depends. There's a lot of variables that come into that classification process to determine where they're going to end up.
Thank you. Representative Kopp, and after Representative Kopp's questions, why don't we go on to the next presentation? I do want to get to House Bill 12 before we finish today. Representative Kopp, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Ledoux brought up a good point about the percentage of people that actually get the reentry programming, because the data points we've seen over the years in this committee is that those that do get it have a remarkably lower incidence of recidivism than those that don't. So I just was supporting her point there. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Kopp. So I think that brings us to our next presentation from the same folks. Just state your name for the record and you can proceed.
For the record, my name is Mike Matthews. I'm the Senior Research Analyst for the Alaska Department of Corrections. This next presentation talks about sanctions and incentives that we've just recently implemented with the Department of Corrections. I'd like to have a quick explanation of what the data is telling us. It's all relatively new to us. We've only been collecting for about a year or so. So we really haven't had the opportunity to do any deep dive analysis in this data because we just haven't been collecting it for long enough. I'd also like to take a little bit of time to point out that I'm the research analyst, so I'm not a practitioner, nor am I a policymaker. So I will stick strictly to the data.
And we'll do our best to keep you on that subject.
Okay, thank you. The first thing I want to talk about is sanctions, and these are actions by a probation officer in response to a negative behavior by an offender, including violations of supervision conditions the PO wants to stop or discourage. So from January 1st, 2017, which is when the sanctions program first started up, to February 5th, we had approximately 21,000 sanction reports. Of those reports, 21,800 had sanctions imposed, and the number of people sanctioned were 4,917. So that's about 4.4 sanctions per person. And here's a list of the sanctions that were imposed in those 26 months. As you can see, the biggest sanction, the most common sanction was PTRs, which is petition to revoke probation or parole.
A PVR is a parole violation report, and a PTR is a petition to revoke probation.
Good, Chair, that's correct.
Okay, good, thank you.
I'm sorry, it's a little cryptic in its language here. This is what is recorded in the database, so once again, I'm not an expert in what these all mean. But I can tell you that they range anywhere from, you know, a written warning to actual reincarceration. And here is the undesired behavior resulting in sanctions. The most common is drug and alcohol-related behavior. And I should point out that there are many, many more behaviors that result in sanctions, and this is my effort to try and distill that down into edible chunks. So when I talk about drug and alcohol, what I'm talking about is someone tests positive on UA or drug paraphernalia is found in their residence. So it's kind of a large pool of sanctions that or behaviors that result in this sanction. So I just want to point that out. And so this could change as we kind of dig deeper into the data. This is just my attempt to try and distill it down into biteable chunks.
Can you tell us what is a PACE violation?
PACE is a swift and certain violation. So if someone has undesired behavior, they're quickly put into incarceration.
And is the PACE a specific group of people on probation or parole that are more intensely supervised, or is that unrelated to the intensive supervision program?
It's a type of supervision. I couldn't say if it's more intense or not.
I see somebody in the back that's...
PACE is a program for assertive community engagement. It was a program with, I think, choices and self-worth.
So, actually, why don't you just come up and tell us... Are you with corrections or? Okay, Ms. Good, can you, Kelly Good, can you come forward and answer the question?
Can you give me, I'll pull it up.
Okay, that's fine. We can, We'll come back to it. I just, it's one of the references that's on there. That the other ones, I think, are more easy to understand, but PACE is a little harder to know what it is. Okay, go ahead and proceed. Thank you.
So moving into incentives, and incentives which include verbal praise are responses to positive pro-social behavior the probation officer wants to reinforce. And as you can see, verbal praise is by far and large the most common type of incentive. About 90% of our incentives are verbal praise. I have to say that, once again, this is new data to us, and having conversations with some of the field officers, we think there's a possibility this could be underreported, but we're still looking into it. And I'd also like to take a little bit of opportunity and do a shameless plug. And a lot of these incentives we cannot pay for, but if someone were to donate movie tickets or a coupon for Subway sandwiches, that would be fantastic.
Right. Representative Ledoux has a question. Go ahead, Representative Ledoux.
So do you have any partnerships with any private organizations, nonprofits, et cetera, to provide those incentives that you can't pay for but you think are effective?
I'm sorry. To the chair, I'm sorry, I cannot answer that question. I don't know.
Who can answer the question?
Ms. Good, is that another question for you? When you come, you don't need to come up. Why don't you wait till you come up with the PACE? You can answer that at the same time you come up for PACE. Proceed.
So next topic is the Earned Compliance Credit, or ECC. So this is basically every month of positive behavior while on probation or parole, 30 days are deducted from supervision. And once it's awarded, it remains even if subsequent undesired behavior is exhibited. So once again, from January 1st, 2017, when it first became live, to March 2nd, 2019, 9,500 probationers and parolees were eligible for ECC. Of those 9,500, 7,800 actually received ECC at least once.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that ECC, is that something that's, you say it's awarded at least once. So for every 30 days, you get sort of a, for every month of positive behavior, you get, so every month it has to be sort of assessed and evaluated and then awarded. It's not like you're in the program, so it's a one-for-one thing. It's like each month if someone, is it one of your listed incentives? ECC earned, AC. 81 ECC earned out of thousands and thousands. Okay. So it's doled out pretty sparingly, it looks like.
Through the chair, that is correct. There's also opportunity to award ECC above and beyond what is here. So in the incentives that you saw, that was additional ECC that was awarded.
So not really a question, but just to put, Representative, to put this in context, as part of the justice reform bills that have passed, there the 30 days credit for 30 days good behavior was one of the measures that was passed in the justice reform efforts. And some of the crime bills that have been introduced this session dials back that credit instead of a 30 for 30 credit, maybe 10 days for 30 days good behavior. And so one of the questions which I'm This gentleman is not here to answer, but this is information about how that program, what's happening with those ECC credits, and this is data related.
Thank you. I guess I have one more question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess my question is it something that's sort of automatically applied for every month that you're on probation and seemingly nothing bad happens? You automatically get a month reduction in your overall probation time, or does it have to be sort of manually allocated each month depending on if you checked off enough boxes?
I'll take a swing at that. To the chair, I'll take a swing at that.
Well, actually, you can take a swing, but you might want to take a swing after you discuss the next slide.
Okay, yeah. That sounds good to me.
which kind of the next slide gets partly to the question you're asking, Representative Wohl.
So this slide looks at how many people who had the opportunity to be awarded ECC were actually awarded ECC. And as you can see, it's about a 50-50 split.
Does that answer the question you had? Or do you
is it awarded based on the discretion of the awarder, or is it awarded based on, as long as you didn't screw up that month, as long as you didn't have any violations, that you automatically get it? Or do you have to, like, be in, does the PO or whoever have to say, all right, I'll give it to you this month?
Through the chair, I'm not an expert in this, but I believe that there is an active participation by the probation officers. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
You can continue.
Question?
Oh, Representative Easton.
Thank you, through the chair. So just do I understand right that, you know, in the whole system total, there was, on slide 8 here, there was, you know, somewhere around 15,000 ECC credits that could have been awarded, and of that number, 7,800 or so were, in fact, awarded? Do I understand the concept correctly?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
You can proceed.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Matthews? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. So I'm curious, is there a way to find out, just focusing on violent reoffenders, you know, how many of the folks that are coming back into custody and being convicted of additional violent crimes, how many of them, you know, benefited previously from the ECC program? Is that kind of data available to us?
Through the chair, we can look at the offense that caused them to become incarcerated, and if they got on probation, and how many of those who are on probation received earned compliance credits. Is that?
Not exactly. I'm
follow up.
Yes, thank you. Also through the chair, wanting to know, so in the event that we had someone in custody, and then they were released, and now they're back in custody again with a conviction for a violent offense. Can we query that pool of people and find out, you know, are these folks recipients of the earned compliance credit, you know, before they came back to us for that violent offense, or not? To what extent? I'd be curious to know if there's any patterns there.
Through the chair, I just want to make sure I understand your question. For those who were on probation who returned to incarceration for violent offense, how many of those were recipients of earned compliance credits, and to what degree?
Correct.
Yes, that's something we can uncover.
Of course, to add to the muddle, the question, not the question Representative Eastman's asking, but the real question about earned compliance credit in the land of recidivism and how long it takes before somebody recidivates, is a person that is convicted and sentenced for a violent crime and then is released, are they committing that violent crime within 3 years, and during that time were they ever released from supervision, or were they actually still under supervision at the time of the new offense? And so the more detailed question would be not just whether somebody may have gotten an earned compliance credit sometimes, but whether they had been released from probation or parole supervision as a product of the earned compliance credit, and then their new criminal behavior occurred after that point. Because even if somebody's earned credit but they're still under supervision, we actually haven't lost track of that individual. They may or may not have committed new offenses, but that adds more to the complexity of trying to analyze that question.
Indeed.
Yes, and if I could add to that real quickly.
Go ahead.
The ECC program hasn't been around for very long, so we're not going to see any long-range recidivation effects for another couple years.
Okay. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So now you say ECC hasn't been around that long, but now Good Time has been around for a while, right? Maybe could you... No, I just... That was all I wanted to know. Thanks.
Okay, I think that's all the, oh, Representative Wohl, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the sanctions section, it looked like there was number of people sanctioned was about 5,000, and you mentioned number of sanctions per person averaged out to about 4.4, with the top one being arrest, after that warrant, another a PACE arrest, et cetera. And then in the incentives, how many people is in that population? Is that the same 4,900, or is that a different group? And that's my first question.
To the chair, it looks at the same population. Now, it's possible there may be some people who are ineligible for ECC who would otherwise be eligible for incentives. So the cohorts may be a little bit different.
Thank you. And quick.
And after this question, we'll get Ms. Good up to tell us about PACE and partners. Partners for incentives.
I guess the incentives, if it's the same population, there's half as many incentives given out. And seeing as verbal praise takes up pretty much all of them, it seems like they're pretty sparse on the old incentive area. You know, a couple bus passes or something like that for 4,000, 5,000 people. If you take the attaboys off the top, then it's pretty sparse, wouldn't you say?
Through the chair, yeah, if you were to remove the verbal praise, which is 90% of the incentives, it would be drastically lower.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Good, can you tell us about PACE and whether we have any either for-profit or non-profit partners in providing, in giving, trying to get more incentives available?
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner of Department of Corrections. So for PACE, it is the Probation Accountability and Certain Enforcement Program. Really what that is doing is working with some of our offenders that we recognize are more likely to perhaps violate probation, and so it's a stricter, more intensive supervision program. It was a pilot program ran for about 2 years, and we still have some people on the PACE program. It's modeled, for those of you that may know, it's modeled after Hawaii's HOPE program. A lot of people often know that, and that's where the idea came from.
And this is a program that is more intensive supervision, checking on them at home more often, going by their workplace more often, just basically want much more intensive contact, and then if they do well, then there's a back off. But if they make even sort of the smallest error, they're quick to bring them back, is essentially the model.
To the chair, that is exactly correct. And also, they are aware when they are a part of the PACE program that the consequences are swift, right? I mean, so they are very aware of the positives that can happen, but also of swift consequences. Yes.
And another question, and I'll ask you because you're here. The question Representative Wohl was asking about the praise, the effort in the department to have more incentives in the probation super is relatively new in the department. Is that part of what we're dealing with on that?
To the chair, Representative Wohl, I don't want to speak to timing. Jen Winkleman could do that. She's in Anchorage today. I will tell you, though, that incentives are definitely being used and are a benefit in probation. There's no doubt about that. We are finding that to be a good way to work with probationers.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any questions for Ms. Good? Go ahead, Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What percentage of people that are released have an alcohol restriction? Or if you don't know now, maybe you can tell me.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I don't have it off the top of my head, but we can find out for you. At least we can get you an idea of alcohol restrictions in general. Are you talking about through probation? Okay.
Yes.
All right. We'll see what we can do for you.
Oh, and the other question that Representative Ledoux had, which you didn't answer, is do you have any nonprofit or for-profit partners for providing, you know, Subway sandwich tickets or tickets to the, you know, bus tickets or
to the chair,
chicken dinners or whatever?
Representative Ledoux, we do. Okay. And they are appreciated. A lot of times it's, I don't want to say nonprofit or profit, it's lots of times businesses. We've had Subway, and that's appreciated. We'll get Subway cards that the probation officers can use for certain incentives. We've heard about certain dinners. That's more in the institutions, that if they reach certain things, they'll get it. So, yes, they are out there. We have different offerings probably in different cities, depending on who's working with us, but those are greatly appreciated by our probation offices when they can hand those out.
Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deputy Commissioner Good, it sounded like maybe the department is backing away from the PACE program. Is that, did I hear that correctly? They're letting it sunset?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, I want to find that out. We still have people on it. As of end of 18, I think we had about 320 still on it. And let me find out the current. It was a grant. So I don't want to tell you that the department itself is backing away from it. I need to find out the current status for you. But we still have people today on the PACE program.
Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Chairman, the PACE program is a program I am familiar with, and as you know, it's intensive supervision, and it's kind of immediate consequence, but because it is intensive and it requires coordination with law enforcement, it's resource intensive too, both for the probation officers and law enforcement. But the data shows, as far as DOC was tracking on it, we had a presentation here last year or two, that it actually is very effective, but you have to fund the program. You have to have the people in place to work it. So I'm just curious, you know, if it was grant based, we should probably, you know, be aware of that and maybe see what kind of success we were having in reducing reoffenses and recidivism.
And on that particular question, Ms. Good, it would actually, because we are, the subcommittees are done, but the finance committee is not. If you could get that to us by the end of next week.
To the chair, definitely.
That would be very helpful, because to the extent that we should be looking at grant funding with state resources to keep that program going, because I remember the earlier presentations that did show that it was very effective in getting folks that might otherwise fall off quickly, that they actually work well with that program, and it has had a lot of success.
Yeah, to the chair, I show 55% were successful on the PACE program.
Okay, I don't see other questions for Ms. Good. Thank you very much. Then, or actually, you may not want to go. You may be the person to answer. The next couple of things we had taking a look at, we can turn the lights on because we're done with the presentation. I had asked corrections to provide a copy of the level of supervision service inventory form, which you all have, and I just wanted whoever is best able to describe how this form is used and how it's used and where it's used in the course of the work you all do.
We both. To the chair, Kelly Good, I'll have Laura Brooks join me as well. The LSIR is actually a form used in our probation offices to assess risk on supervision. So how someone is going to be assessed by risk, then that allows the probation officer to know what level of supervision they will need while on probation. And so I provided, per the chairman, the document of what a probation officer will go through with the probation on intake, right? They'll go through all of those. They will assess the probationer and then determine what level of risk and therefore what level of supervision.
So this is effectively, we've heard about the pretrial risk assessment tool. This is the pre-release at the end of their sentence assessment tool.
To the chair, actually that is almost technically after release, because this would happen in the probation office.
Okay. Any questions about the form or that process? Okay, and then the other query I had, as part of the justice reform legislation, the department was supposed to have regulations issued with regard to the pretrial assessment tool, and just, can you give us an update on the status of the pretrial assessment tool regulations, and do we have them, or where? What's the status if we haven't adopted them yet?
To the chair, thank you. It has been unfortunate, but we have determined that the Department of Corrections in the prior administration did not do all of the regulations per Senate Bill 91 or other similar bills. We have done our research. We have found that there was one started. Unfortunately, when a regulation is started, there is a time period in which it must be completed. It lapsed. It is the risk assessment tool that you and I spoke about. So what we are doing now is working with the Department of Law to see how we can bring that back about and then continue on so that so that the regulation does get moved forward, and we are in that process.
And do you, can you give us any kind of a timeline on yet whether when you think the regulations can
To the chair, I did try to find that out today for you. I did not get an answer back. I will. We can get it up and going pretty quickly. I just don't know what the time frame, what we have to wait. It was noticed in the paper. I'm hoping we don't have to do that again because of the lapse. I'm hoping we can pick up somewhere in the middle, you know, to get it going. But we are aware of it, and we're working on it.
And can you also give us an update on that by the end of next week also?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions for anyone from corrections? Hearing and seeing none. Thank you very much for the presentations. That I think is very informative and helpful. Our second order of business today is House Bill 12, Protective Order, sponsored by Representative Kopp. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. At this time, I would like to take up amendments to House Bill 12. I'll put on the record that Legislative Legal has permission to make any technical and conforming changes to the bill, and assuming we get through all the amendments, it is my intention to move the bill today. The amendment process will be treated like floor amendments. The maker of the amendment moves the amendment and speaks to it with a three-minute time limit. Then we'll take questions, and questions will be limited to 1 minute per question. Then we will proceed to discussion with each member limited to 3 minutes. And finally, the maker of the amendment will have 1 minute to wrap up. When we come to an amendment, the mover can either move the amendment or it will be withdrawn, and we will not roll amendments to the back. And that brings us to amendment number one, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will not be moving amendment one, but I would ask a question, Mr. Chairman. Wait a second. I was looking at the bill drafters, the attorney's name on there.
I think this was the amendment you
yes,
submitted.
Yes, I will be moving amendment one. Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment 131-LS0103/K.2.
Object
for purposes of discussion.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman,
thank you for the objection.
Also, may I ask for your privilege of having my staff come forward here?
That's fine.
Ken Truitt, my office.
I'll let
just
your
so that
staff
he
explain
has,
the amendment.
He,
or you can.
But, well, I like having his great counsel available to me in the committee, but so, Mr. Chairman, the court, in the process of reviewing this with them, this protective order statute is something that the court system deals with scores of times daily throughout our state, and they mentioned that as the bill is currently worded, with the inclusion of language as specified in this amendment, it would clarify the issue of a person who maybe have been denied coming back immediately to the court asking again for reconsideration when nothing has in fact changed. So this would just clarify that the petitioner would allege a change in circumstance since the court's previous finding, and the court would find that much more practical to work with on a daily basis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Truitt, did you want to add anything to Representative Kopp's?
For the record, Ken Truitt, staff to Representative Kopp. No, I have nothing further to add to that.
Questions for the maker of the amendment, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And I guess this could be either for the sponsor or drafter or both. Now, it would certainly seem to me if this law passes that would have changed at least one circumstance since prior to the passage of the law that was not the case. Would that in and of itself be a sufficient change in circumstance for the purposes of this type of request?
Representative Eastman, could you repeat
the
question?
Sure.
Thank you.
So of all the various changes in circumstances one could cite to support a new request, it would certainly seem to me that the law has changed would be one. And if this bill does become law, that would be a changing circumstance, correct? Would that be sufficient in and of itself?
If I would say that if a petitioner decided they had a ruling against them, that this new law would indicate that now the law more clearly says that their case could be considered, I could see a petitioner saying, Your Honor, as a result of House Bill 12, I feel that there is now available to me a process to ask for this petition. In other words, get my initial request for protective order renewed or extended. It's conceivable that, however, I don't know how far back you can go on those. If an order has already expired and the case is already closed, you would still have to convince the court not just that the law has changed, but that it is still necessary to protect your safety that this protective order be issued. So that always has to be before the court, that it is necessary to protect you. So I guess you're asking a question, extreme hypothetical. I don't know it's possible.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Eastman, I would note that it does raise this sort of interesting question. If somebody applied for a protective order December 1st of last year and didn't get the protective order, and then, miracle of miracles, the legislature passes a bill before August, say, and that gets signed into law, and so 6 months later they come and say, well, the law just changed. That's a very different circumstance than somebody who 2 days before the law gets written in and signed by the governor and becomes law, 2 days before the law, they don't get a protective order, then they come in and say, now things have changed. So it's, I think it is sort of hard to follow all those potential hypotheticals just when the law changes. Looks like Mr. Truitt has a comment as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Kopp. I think one concrete answer that we could offer would be that I think, through the chair, Representative Eastman, in one circumstance, I think yes. And that would be, if you look at the applicability clause of the bill, which is on page 2, starting on line 28, if this law is passed and enacted, it will apply to all protective orders that are in effect as the date of passage, that were issued before passage and on the day of passage and obviously after passage. So if there is a protective order that is out there that meets the substantive requirements of this bill, it's within 30 days of lapsing, or it has been 60 days, within 60 days that it has lapsed, then I think a partial answer to your question is those protective orders, yes. I think the extension of your question, could that person come back the next day, should that have request to extend that protective order have been denied, could they come back the next day with your hypothetical that was this law passage a sufficient reason? I would think that would be up to the discretion of the judge at that point. And I would I won't speculate. I'd just say it would be within the discretion of the court hearing that request at that point.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the maker of the amendment? Hearing and seeing none, is there any further discussion about this amendment? Hearing and seeing none, is the objection maintained, Representative?
No.
And Representative Ledoux, okay. So there are the objection is withdrawn and a new objection has not been registered. That means amendment number 1 is adopted unanimously. That brings us next to amendment number 2, and I think the remaining amendments are from Representative Eastman, so the motion is to represent amendment number 2.
Well, I would have one question, Mr. Chairman. I would suppose a logical way of dealing with this would be just to deal with amendment number 5 first, because that does contain all the other amendments.
Well, I'm happy to take up a number 5, but my general practice has been when we number the amendments, we take them in order, and if you choose to pass on the first 3, then
I'm more than willing to go step by step.
Let's stay in order and go one at a time. Start with number 2, please.
I'll move amendment number 2.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yes, so what this is doing is it's just making it very clear that just the fact alone that someone is calling in telephonically is not reason to deny a protective order, in addition to the other reasons we're listing. And I can offer as a personal experience to that, you know, I did have the unfortunate experience of driving a friend to a courthouse to deal with a protective order issue, and that that would have meant that person having to confront their abuser, and that was just too hard for them to do at that exact time and place. And they were told by the clerk at the court that, you know, unless they, you know, signed in person their request, that it wouldn't be accepted, and that they couldn't do it outside of the courtroom. They couldn't do it, you know, at the clerk's office. They had to actually show up in court and go under oath and that sort of thing. So anyways, long story short, that person did not receive a protective order. And I just want to make clear that not being able to or not being in a position to show up in person and confront your accuser or your abuser or their attorney is not going to make it so that you can't get your protective order.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I personally have helped people many times over the telephone get protective orders, and so I believe there's nothing in the law that prevents or that even discourages telephonic application of protective orders. Emergency protective orders are almost always done over the phone, generally by a police officer or with the person present with them. Generally, those are 72-hour orders. The ex parte orders, the 20-day orders, my understanding is that the courts routinely handle those telephonically. So I think this amendment is unnecessary, that it's not adding anything that the court already doesn't do as a matter of practice. And if I'm mistaken, I'd like to hear from the courts.
I see Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the court system, is here, and it looks like she's not suggesting that Representative Kopp got that wrong. I had a question for the maker of the amendment. Was the person that you were assisting, were they applying for an ex parte order, or were they going for the long-term domestic violence restraining order? Do you know?
Sure.
Well, because it's the scenario you described is sort of confusing to me, because typically the first order is ex parte, where somebody doesn't confront their accuser, they're signing up for the ex parte order, and that typically is granted. And so you're saying, even though that day there was no need to confront the person, they still didn't want to sign the request?
No, I'm talking about it was for the follow-up.
Well, but there was no document. Typically, there's no documents to sign when you go for the long-term order, because those documents are all signed when you first go for the ex parte. Well,
yeah.
So, okay, well, sounds like there's opposition to them. Any further questions or discussion as to the amendment number two?
Well, I would respond to Representative Kopp and say, you know, if this bill were only dealing with those 72-hour or ex parte protective orders, I would be inclined to agree that maybe that wasn't necessary. But since this bill seems to be a little bit more broad, I think there may be a need for this amendment.
And I would just add, there's a rules in both the civil rules and the criminal rules that provide allow telephonic appearance. So I share Representative Kopp's view that it doesn't seem necessary. Representative Kopp?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would say that if I thought it would do good or enhance the process, I'd be all for it. But whether it's emergency protective orders, ex parte 20-day orders, or long-term one-year protective orders, I believe the court handles all those telephonically now. So, and I'm very willing to be corrected on that.
Okay. Sounds like the objection is maintained.
Can I wrap up?
You get your, wait, before you get, does anyone have any further comment before Representative Eastman wraps up on amendment number two? Representative Wohl.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess hearing that it's not needed, a confirmed affirmation of that would be, and maybe Representative Kopp and yourself is giving that. I don't know. I just want to make sure that it's not needed, that it's already sort of intrinsically in other statutes.
Ms. Mead, why don't you come up and confirm
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I do know that Representative Kopp is correct that the court system routinely hears and grants protective orders that are done in through telephonic hearings.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. And so as the law stands right now, or I guess rather as the bill stands right now, could a court use those circumstances dealing with the telephonic appearance to deny a protective order?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, if you're asking can the court deny it just because the person is appearing telephonically and not in person, no. And they, again, routinely grant them whether they're telephonic or in person, or assess them and not grant them. But it doesn't make any difference to the court, and they happen quite often telephonically.
Thank you.
And I would just, following back to the on the long-term orders, to not allow the respondent to appear at a long-term domestic violence order would run into constitutional issues about the confrontation clause, if somebody could go to the long-term order and not have to appear or be able to avoid the opponent if the opponent wanted to appear.
To the chair, at the long-term order, the respondent is there for due process issues, and the statute provides for that, as opposed to the short-term order, as you mentioned.
Right. Okay.
Correct.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Eastman, I think this is your wind-up.
Oh, I just wanted to follow up there.
Sure, go ahead.
So telephonic would not then be permitted in that long-term setting?
Through the chair, telephonic is permitted often, and yes, a respondent could appear telephonically, but they have the right to appear. So the respondent we're talking about has the right to appear telephonically. Respondents sometimes don't appear at all. And similarly, the petitioner, the person who is alleging the crime of domestic violence for that statute, can appear telephonically at any of the hearings.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Ledoux, go ahead.
Well, I'm totally confused now, because I thought you had I thought you said at one time that the petitioner could appear telephonically for the long-term protective order, but then I thought you said that if you allowed the petitioner to appear telephonically for the long-term protective order, that would involve constitutional issues and the right to confront your accuser. So did I hear wrong one of those times?
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, and if I was confusing, I'm sorry about that. Petitioners have the right to appear telephonically at any hearing, the 72-hour, the short-term, or the long-term. Petitioners can appear telephonically, period. Respondents, which was a different question, that is the person who is accused of committing the crime of domestic violence or stalking or sexual assault, they typically don't know about the 72-hour short term, so I'm not talking about those. At the long-term hearing, they have a right to be, quote, present. They get notice because of due process, and they have the right to be present. They can choose to be present telephonically if they wish to, but they do have the constitutional due process right to know that this proceeding is occurring against them, because it could result in a grave consequence against them.
So, follow up. So they don't have the right in a long-term protective order to confront their accusers in person, like you might have the right, I think you've got that right in a criminal trial, but I don't think that domestic violence restraining order, I think that comes under our civil rules, perhaps, as opposed to?
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, you are correct. This is not a criminal proceeding where the respondent is a criminal defendant, and so there are different protections, but they are civil proceedings. Domestic violence protective orders are civil. However, they have still have the due process right to know that there's a hearing going on, and they can opt to come and say their piece or defend themselves so that an order won't issue. But they can also do that by telephone. And they can't insist that the petitioner appear so that they can cross-examine that petitioner who was allegedly the victim of a crime of domestic violence. That's how it works in the civil protective order world.
Thank you.
All right, now it's time for wind up on amendment number two. Representative Eastman, you got a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I can get this into a minute, though I think usually there's a little bit longer. I think this amendment is actually very much needed for two reasons. One, because we are, you know, taking the step in this bill to spell these things out, not just for the judges to know, you know, why they shouldn't be denying orders, but also because there's education to the public, and someone who is going to go and consider applying for one of these orders is going to have the statute available to say, you know, what the reasons are for their applying and how it's not going to be denied. And I want to encourage people who, you know, may not be able to appear in person to be able to still go through and have the support of the process to file that request for a protective order.
Thank you. Please call the roll.
Representative Ledoux?
No.
Representative Wool?
No.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Representative Shaw?
No.
Representative Cobb?
No.
Representative Stutes, not present. Chair Klayman?
No.
Mr. Chair, that is one yay, five nay.
So by a vote of 1-5, amendment number two has failed. Representative Eastman, would you
Thank
like
you.
To move amendment number three?
I move amendment number three.
Check.
There's an objection for purposes of discussion. Go ahead, Representative Eastman. Tell us about amendment number three.
Thank you. And so you'll see a similar portion from the previous amendment. The new language is going to be on page 1, line 7. Currently, the language is the stalking or act of sexual assault was the basis for a previous protective order. And what this does is it expands that slightly so that if the stalking act or sexual assault was a contributing portion of the basis for previous protective order, that it could not be denied on those grounds. And I think this gives additional protections to those who are in need of protective orders and are able to apply for them and will not be discouraged or have those requests denied for this reason.
Representative Kopp.
Has there been objection for purposes
there
of discussion?
There has been objection. Representative Willis.
Thank you. Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, this is one of those things, you know, where I had to read it 5 or 6, 7 times, and I could not see any value other than confusion. If I was a judge asking, what does this add? Because you will only issue a protective order if you've already made a probable cause finding that the act of stalking or sexual assault occurred. So here it says, insert, that basically the court made that finding based on those acts or a contributing factor. In other words, whether he's talking about a contributing factor to those acts or another thing the court took into consideration, but the fact is an order would never have been issued unless the court found that the stalking or act of sexual assault was a basis for the previous, and it really wouldn't matter what other things happened. You know, the kitchen table wasn't cleared off, the car was out of gas. You know, if they find that the stalking or sexual assault had occurred, probable cause, they would issue the order. And I would think this would be confusing to the courts, and I certainly would like to hear from them. If
Representative Shaw.
Mr. Chair, I read it 5 times, and then I got an interpretation of it, and I'm still confused.
So in the courts, they would say, objection, vague and confusing. Ms. Mead, it sounds like Representative Kopp would like you to provide the court's perspective on amendment number 3.
Thank you. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. And I guess I'm not totally clear on what the amendment is trying to do, and as Representative Kopp said, the court needs to have a finding if we stick to, I know there's two different protective orders at issue here, but if it's a petition for a domestic violence protective order, the court makes a specific finding that there was an incident and that it was a crime of domestic violence, and that is why they issue a protective order. So in an extension, I'm not sure what, I guess I'm not totally clear on what this is, what this would capture either.
Representative Eastman, there seems to be a consistent objection about vague and ambiguous. You can try to lift the veil of confusion from all
through
of
the chair.
Minds.
Yes, well, drafters have interesting conventions for how they put things together. I think the question would be, as the bill is before us right now without this amendment, if a previous protective order had been issued that was only a contributing factor to the basis for this stalking or sexual assault was only a contributing factor, you know, would our courts be able to use that fact within the limits of their discretion, of course, to deny that protective order? And I think the easiest way to understand it would be if you change the word the on line 7 to the word a, recognizing that it wasn't the basis, but that it you know, was in there somewhere, contributed to, would a court be able to deny it for that reason? And so this amendment is saying that the really does need to be an A in order to extend the protection.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I'm trying to answer the question in the appropriate way, because whenever there's a protective order issued, it's because the court found there was an incident and there was an act of domestic violence, or for the other one, page one, sexual assault or stalking. So the court in its order says, this is the incident that is leading me to issue this order. And I don't know how that incident, I'm not certain, and I'm trying to see if there would be other incidents that contributed to that conclusion. But since each order is based on an incident, I guess I'm still unclear on what might be a contributing factor.
Follow up?
Representative Eastman,
thank you.
I'm not sure this is a question for Ms. Mead, but you can give it a try. I'm going to pretty quickly move to wind-up comments because I haven't lifted the – have done little to lift the confusion from my perspective. But
thank you. So if you're a person that's coming to the court and you're filling out your request for why you want your protective order, is there really only space in that form to just list one incident? Is that all you're allowed to argue for? Or is it, you know, fairly common for someone to list multiple different reasons and events and incidences, all of which may have independently, you know, resulted in a request, or over the passage of time, someone for whatever reason did not take upon themselves to apply for a protective order, even though they had a right to, but at some point they come to the court and now they've got all these different things, you know, piled up.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I see a little bit more of what you're getting at now. And yes, petitioners often will list three or four or five incidents that they want to rely upon at the hearing to say to the judge, and this was an incident that equals a crime of domestic violence, for example. The court issues an order, and in the order, the court has check boxes. The court finds by a preponderance of evidence that the respondent committed or attempted to commit the following crimes of domestic violence. And if more than one, say it's assault and kidnapping or custodial interference, and I'm looking at the order, if two boxes are checked, those neither is a contributing factor to the other. Those would each be a basis, the basis for the prior protective order, so that the language of the bill as written would cover this appropriately, in my opinion.
Thank you. That being said, I withdraw the amendment.
Amendment number 3 is withdrawn. That brings us next to amendment number 4.
I move amendment number 4.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you very much.
Tell us how this is different from 2 or 3.
So amendment number 4 is different only in that it is combining these, and also you'll note making them applicable to each of the protective orders. But since the committee hasn't seen fit to find them in the individual case, I will withdraw that amendment as well and move amendment number 5.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Representative Eastman, go ahead.
Thank you. And the distinction you'll see here on this amendment is page 1, line 12, and then also on the following page, and that is making clear that...
Wait, page 1, line 12...
Of the amendment.
Of the amendment or page 1, line 12 of the bill?
Of the amendment.
Of the amendment, okay.
And so the language here is dealing with geography, and it's been mentioned previously that, you know, someone could come to the court and ask for a protective order and have good grounds and be able to demonstrate that bad things happened, and yet that protective order can be denied because the court believes that the abuser or other party, you know, has flown down to California and is not nearby to be protected against. And I think in an earlier time in our state's history, that might have made great sense. But with the speed of air travel and the reduced costs, you can go from California to here within a day. And if someone shows up on your doorstep right now, you weren't expecting them this morning, but here they are, and you're afraid that that might be the case, it certainly would make sense for someone to be able to go to a court and ask for a protective order on that basis, realizing that, you know, by the time someone's already flown in and showed up on your doorstep, it's a little late to go to the court and ask for a protective order. So I think this is important that we clarify to the court that just the fact that someone currently isn't in the neighborhood is no reason to deny someone's protective order, because they certainly have the right to be protected and to feel protected. And if we can do that through a protective order, I think we should.
So I'll ask a question, then let Representative Cobb have a turn. What happens if the petitioner says, I'm scared of this person, they're in prison in Florida, they're not going to be released for a year, but I still want the protective order today to last for 6 months? Why can't the court look at that and say, geographically, I don't see there's a present risk, so I'm not going to grant the order now?
Well, I think this this doesn't limit that situation, because you're dealing with incarceration. And so it wouldn't be the fact that they're in Florida, it would be the fact that they're incarcerated, whether they're in Florida or Alaska or anywhere else. I think courts have certainly denied protective orders on that basis, and they would be able to continue to do so.
Representative Cobb, question or comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I think this is, you know, a solution in search of a problem to begin with. There's not a problem that the courts have to find as a matter of a judicial determination. I'm not sure what their standard is, if it's probable cause or if it's some other reasonableness standard, but they have to find that it is necessary to protect the safety of the petitioner. And part of that finding is what happened to you, who did it, and where is this person, and is there an investigation? And, you know, I mean, all these things come out, and Representative Eastman is right that we have a mobile society, but part of every query of the court is determining the probability of a person being hurt. And as you pointed out, Mr. Chairman, if the person is under the custody of the Department of Corrections in Florida or any other state, and the court is able to verify that, yeah, the courts would be very unlikely to find that it is necessary to protect this person, unless maybe there were things in there that prevented phone calls or other things that could be helpful. But as far as the finding of being physically attacked, I could see them denying it. But the court already does this now. And similarly to the telephonic thing, we end up adding a lot of language to the law, which I think confuses the courts. This is all part of their common sense application of making a causal determination of whether or not a petitioner is at risk of being harmed, and to say that a court may not deny a petition solely because of the current geographic location of this respondent. I mean, Alaska is a huge state. If we were a country, we'd be one of the top 10 in the world. Our court already does this. You know, they already, doesn't matter if the person's in Accutan and another person's in Anchorage, the court already takes these into consideration, and it's completely unnecessary in my view. Thank you.
You might be up at wind-up, Representative Eastman. I don't see any other questions or comments. Representative Eastman, wind-up.
Yeah.
I believe the objection is maintained.
I appreciate the response from the bill sponsor. Unfortunately, I think if the argument holds that the court, you know, can come up with its own justification based on common sense and doesn't need us to list out these, you know, particulars like where someone's located or calling in by phone or anything else, then what's the purpose of the bill? I think you just talked me out of supporting the bill if that's the case. But if it is the case that there's value in putting these things into statute, then I think we should absolutely make sure that everyone who comes before the court knows that the fact that their ex-boyfriend who happens to have just skedaddled down to California, you know, is going to be restrained by this protective order, then they should go ahead and make that request. And we should make it clear to them that they have every right to, we should encourage them to, and we should encourage our courts to give them the peace of mind that would come with having filed that protective order and knowing that that person, should they choose to show up today or tomorrow or next week.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. That's your 1 minute wind up. Mr. Secretary, if you could call the roll.
Representative Stutes, not present. Representative Ledoux?
No.
Representative Wool?
No.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Representative Shaw?
No.
Representative Kopp?
No.
Chair Klain?
No.
Chair Klain?
So by a vote of 1-5, amendment number 5 has failed. And I would just make a note, Representative Eastman, I know you sometimes offer a number of amendments to our bills. If there's an order you'd like to take the amendments up in the future, when you submit the amendments, tell us the order you'd like us to take those up in, because I actually, based on your memo, which had them in the same order that we listed them, I'm more than happy to give you.
Certainly.
But I also want to stay on a steady path. So
certainly. I think it has a lot to do with, you know, where the committee wants to go with it, certainly. But yeah.
That brings House Bill 12 back before the committee. First of all, are there any other questions that we haven't talked about before for the bill sponsor or his staff? I don't see any. We also have a couple of people here that can answer questions. Maggie Hum, I think, is online from Anchorage, and Christine Pate from Sitka. Maggie Hem is the supervising attorney for Alaska Legal Services, and Christine Page is the legal program director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Again, I see no questions for those folks. That brings the bill back to before us for final comments, and consistent with floor practices, everyone gets one comment, one chance to comment if they want, and Representative Kopp gets the final word. Any comments on House Bill 12 as amended? Hearing and seeing none, Representative Ledoux, may I have a motion?
I move version 30-LSO103/K of House Bill 12 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Hearing and seeing no objection, House Bill 12 moves from committee. Our initial intent was to take up any questions we might have on House Bill 49, but it's 3:05, and rather than do that, we will, at some point, probably next week, we will take up House Bill 49 again under bills previously heard, and I'll let you try to give you some advance, probably just through an email from my staff. We'll just have it, we won't have it specifically listed. It'll just be potential come up as bills previously heard. And with that, we will adjourn for the day. We are not meeting on Friday, March 29. Our next meeting will be Monday, April 1st at 1 p.m. And with that, we will stand adjourned. It is now 2:56 p.m.